Hi, and welcome to the Dinner Agenda. This is Beau. And this is CeeLo. Hello, CeeLo. How are you doing?
What's going on?
Nothing. What's going on with you?
Well, since you asked, I have an interesting update because recently we did a little episode called High School Flashback. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
We had a little fun chat about that. And on our Instagram, we asked people, would you or would you not go to a high school reunion? Turns out that 70% of people agree with me and they would go to their high school reunion.
I don't believe you. Are you being truthful?
I'm being truthful. The last time I looked, it said 70% of people would
go.
Are
these 70% your friends or are these 70% drunk people?
I just went in and voted it up to say, go, go, go.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't know who it was. Maybe it was two people. I don't know. But it turns out that those two people, all of our massive amounts of followers, would go to their high school. Curiosity killed the cat, man. That's why people want to go and check it out.
Well, you know, it's funny because I've been hearing from some folks that I know who had listened to the podcast and they were like, yeah, you need to go. You need to go. So you might win this battle, CeeLo. You just might win it.
Okay. So we'll have to keep an eye on when the next reunion is.
Yeah.
The other thing which I thought was funny is somebody did message us to say that they too did one of those fancy glamour shots. So we'll have to find that and post it once she sends it to us. Yeah.
Okay. I want to see that because for the longest time I felt like I was the only one who actually paid for these stupid pictures of these glamour shots. That is flipping hysterical. Okay. I think what we need to do is if anybody has these glamour shots, they need to send them to us.
They need to send them.
We need to do a collage.
A collage. And then post it. Mm-hmm. I like it. Yeah. I think we'll call it Gina Hair Don't Care. Yeah. 80s Gina Hair Don't Care.
Can call it shut up and whatever. Okay, so what are we talking about today?
It's good times. Well, we have a bit more of a serious topic today, to be perfectly honest. I mean, one of the goals of us doing this podcast was to really have those open and honest, kind of candid conversations about our experiences in the hopes that it helps others, right? Helps others feel less alone or just gain some insight and better understanding of how different experiences affect different people and help people kind of navigate the path. So we are absolute 100% firm believers in all feelings are valid. We have that love is love, be kind mantra for sure behind us. Mm-hmm. And so before we get started, I had seen a couple things about emotionally immature parents and how that can impact children. And I think that I'm looking at it like, am I emotionally available for my kids, right? Like, so I have a bit of a different perspective, but it also forces you to think about the relationship that you had kind of with your parents. So a couple of things that I learned was that emotionally immature parents can sometimes emotionally kind of dump on their children. They rely on their children for emotional support to kind of pump them up. Total lack of empathy and struggle with boundaries and struggle to regulate their own emotions. So, you know, it's basically a parent that's incapable, right? It's you say emotionally immature. I mean, all those things kind of sound like a kid, almost like a toddler in my mind, right? Like
yeah, you're right.
Acting, but.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny because you're saying about, you know, them being incapable, I guess it's based on what you were just saying. It's the inability, I guess, to meet the child's emotional needs. Right. And I think that from what I've learned in the past as well, that's actually a generational thing. So that kind of behavior, it passes from one generation to the next. Because these children end up parenting like they had been parented, right? It's what
they
know.
You do what you've learned your life.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And there's so much out in the community these days, in the media these days as well, about narcissists and, you know, that kind of stuff. And you know, I know that those are topics that we, you know, will definitely touch on throughout this podcast. But one key thing I think is important to note that, you know, all narcissists are known to be emotionally immature, but not all emotionally immature parents qualify with full traits of someone having narcissistic narcissistic personality disorder. So I think it's important to note that, you know, if you have grown up maybe potentially with an emotionally immature parent who may not have met all of your emotional needs, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are narcissistic or that they have narcissistic personality disorder. Yeah. But on the flip side, it could be, right? Yeah. We just, you know, we don't know, but either way.
Yeah, regardless. I mean, I think it's the important part is that it is a recognized kind of form of abuse. And that's why I think it's really important to talk about it. You know, as we prep the podcast and we investigate the different topics, we ended up meeting a lot of different people, and a lot of different people have reached out to us to share kind of their experiences and things that they've gone through. Mm-hmm. And that's why today this episode is extra special, because we have our very first guest that we'll be talking to about their experiences growing up with emotionally immature parents and the impact, you know, that has had on her adult life. I would like to introduce everyone to Jen. Thanks, Jen, so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm very delighted to be here.
We are delighted to have you join us too, Jen. We're super psyched.
Wonderful. So, I was having a hard time not like popping in when y'all were discussing glamour shots. I had glamour shots done.
Did you?
Send y'all a picture. I totally
did. Oh my gosh.
The big hair, the big bangs.
Oh my gosh. Okay, Jen, you're sending us your glamour shot.
Yeah, I'm totally doing it.
That's hysterical. That's awesome. I'm glad I'm not.
It was the rite of passage. Yeah. Like when I became a woman and started my period, that was like glamour shots was the answer. It's my gift.
Love it. Absolutely love it. Okay, let's get into your story, Jen. So we know that you've had a lots of lifetime of experiences. And so we're going to be focusing a little bit on, you know, the early parts first of your life. And when did you actually realize that you may have emotionally immature parents? Like, walk us through a little bit about, you know, how you felt kind of growing up and when you began discovering that maybe things weren't quite right.
Gosh, you know, I was so inundated with it. I think there might have been a small part of me that recognized that something was off, but because it was so normalized in our family, I kind of pushed that little quiet voice down and just sort of gave in to the model and the patterns. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until later when I left my narcissistic ex that it was sort of like that was sort of a catalyst to take the fog off of my brain and help me see more clearly, because I didn't realize my ex was a narcissist until 2 weeks after I left him. Mm. And once that happened and I did that for myself, it was like the first time I've ever done anything for me, not based on what other people told me I should do or whatever, that this fog lifted and I was able to see my parents more clear. Mm-hmm. Because I had sort of created this fantasy of a family, this lens that I was looking at family through, and thought I had this great childhood and my parents are so amazing and my brothers are great. And I just said sort of whitewashed them in my mind. Mm-hmm. I think as a way to survive it, you know, and not actually looking at the facts or looking at the truth of what was actually happening. So I moved back in with my parents after I left my ex, and I started seeing behavior and I was like, what in the world? And at the time I thought, you know, why are my parents acting like this? But then I started looking into my childhood and realizing this is a pattern. This has been happening for a really long time. I just was giving myself amnesia and, like, you know, skirting past it, sweeping things under the rug, mm-hmm. to the point where all I saw was the surface pretty things, you know?
It's kind of amazing when you, you know, I think of that Oprah aha moment, right? So you leave your, your ex-husband, and which I'm sure was like a huge step, a huge, you know, strength position for you to get to that point. And then all of a sudden you're like, realizing how deep that, you know, what that narcissist, living with a narcissist, how deep that went, and then realize it's almost like all of a sudden your brain is exploding 10 times over with all the different
Yeah. And hindsight is amazing. I think it's one of the greatest gifts we've been given to be able to look back. I mean, I know sometimes it sucks. You're like, oh, great. You know, but to be able to look back and pick out patterns. And I'm a very curious person and I love psychology. And so I was like digging right away, like, what is this? And how does this work? And how, why did it happen? Mm-hmm. And, you know, asking all the why questions. I'm just very, I'm like a cat. I'm
yeah. And that was what I was going to kind of touch on. I was going to ask you, Jen, because typically, from what I'm aware of, it's quite normal for people to go through a good portion of their lives thinking that their family was one way, because that's what you're conditioned to believe, right? It's all you know. And then something happens within your life that begins making you question. And that's when your eyes start to open and you begin to learn. But for you, so you said it was when you left your narcissistic ex-husband, but, and then you moved back in with your family, but did you kind of like start having these aha moments on your own, or did you start with therapy first? Like, how did that, was it really just observing once you got back into your family home?
Yes.
Or was there more to, yeah. Okay. So tell me.
Cause I had been in therapy with the marital stuff with my ex-husband, but I didn't even think to look at my childhood. Now, I will say that with my therapist back in Virginia, when I was explaining to him my childhood and what was happening, especially the physical stuff that my dad did, he was the first one to actually say, this is abusive. This is abuse. And it kind of blew my mind. I was like, wait a minute, you know, because again, it had been so normalized. And spanking, I think, has been very normalized as well. But I think there's a line there. Yeah. And once I get into what was happening within that, it'll sort of uncover some things. But I think even the idea of looking at your family under a microscope, I felt like that was wrong. Like, it's not allowed. It's against the rules. It's against the family law. It felt so wrong to do that. I think I stayed really far away from even allowing myself to. Because it was just this whole sweet, everybody sweeps things under the rug. We put on a pretty show.
Yeah.
And to question it or to look at it too closely, wrong, wrong, wrong. Like, you're not allowed to do that. And I think that plays into growing up in a Christian family and the whole idea of honor your father and mother. Well, I took that to such a degree that even questioning their parenting or what happened or how they did things felt very disrespectful. And I just had on such a high pedestal, respect your parents, honor your parents, you know, over and over and over. And just from the patterns of how our family functioned, that also played into the messages that I got that, you know, looking at things too closely is wrong. Questioning things, not allowed at all.
Yeah. So that's a good point. And, you know, I can understand that growing up in the Christian, you know, faith, having that kind of be dictated as well, but culturally also. Right.
Yes.
That absolutely. That can play a role. I think for certain cultures, I know even just for my Italian background, you know, it's you're very much having to respect the parents, right? They are, the boss of all. So I get where you're coming from with that. That's interesting. So, would you say, like, just out of curiosity, do you think that when you go back and start looking at your family, do you think that there was narcissism in your family, or do you think it was something more along the lines of what CeeLo was talking about, which is maybe just emotionally immature parents, or do you think it was just all everyone was conditioned from perhaps a religious perspective to kind of behave in certain ways? What are your thoughts?
That's a great question. Okay. I'm still in the question regarding my dad because there are some things that he does that just scream to me narcissistic. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's a full-blown narcissist. Like, I'm not a doctor or anything. I can't go there. But it's very strange that the way he behaves. Now, it could be just I do believe it could just be emotionally immature. Mm-hmm. But there are certain things that have happened that I'm like, I don't know if it's just that. It kind of tweaks my brain. Like it's like a little alarm going off and I'm like, maybe I should look at this. So I'm still in the question regarding my dad. With my mom, I think it's just more of emotionally immature. But again, I could be wrong. I think when you start looking into narcissism, the tactics they use, especially to just confuse you, I get very confused when I think about my parents and sure. the good things they've done and the bad things they've done and the off things they've done. It's very confusing, which tends to make me think, okay, at least maybe there are some narcissistic traits there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the emotional immature, yeah, that's definitely flying.
Can you give us some examples of that from your childhood that you realize now is a symptom of having emotionally immature parents, just so that
Absolutely.
People can understand kind of what you went through?
Yeah. So the patterning in our family, especially surrounding like punishment, it was very much, my mom wasn't really, had anything to do with discipline or punishment. It was mainly my dad. From what I can remember, because I don't know how, if anybody else deals with this, but I have a lot of blank from my childhood. I don't know if it was from being disassociated, from just the rage that was happening. And I was very scared. But I even talked to my brother the other day and I asked him, what percentage of your childhood do you remember? And he was like, probably 15-20%. And that's the same as me. But there are specific things, especially the negative things that stand out in my mind that really traumatized me. So one of them was my dad would spank us, but in my opinion, he went overboard. And what would happen was I was sent to my room and my heart would be shattering. I was so upset that I had made him that angry. Mm. Nobody ever came to me. Nobody ever came to my room to comfort me or to remind me, hey, I still love you. Like mm-hmm. we're okay. And that you're not a bad kid. You just did a bad thing. So because there was just no one coming to me to talk through it or to have any kind of resolution, I was left crying in my room for hours and filling in these blanks that my parents had left open, to where I was trying to figure it out. Even at a young age, I was trying to figure out, what did I do? How do I not do it again? Why did this happen? And so I just started giving myself these messages of, I'm a bad kid. I'm broken. I can't do anything right. Just really, really negative messages. And the other thing that didn't help was when I got up in the morning and very timidly would go to the kitchen for breakfast, being afraid that my dad was still in this raging place. I would come into the kitchen and everybody acted like nothing had happened. Yeah. There still was no conversation after the fact. Mm-hmm. There was no, hey, are you okay? It just was all swept under the rug and acted like nothing had happened. And this is something my ex did as well, which I don't know if that falls under narcissism. Y'all can share your opinions, but this whole idea of blowing up at you to the point where you're internally or externally or both a mess, and then they flip and they're fine.
Yeah. So,
and they expect you to continue on like nothing happened. And you're over here, like, I'm picking up the pieces of my flesh off of the ground, like yeah. emotionally, you know what I mean? You're just yeah. like, wait, what? So,
you know,
that was one of the big things.
Yeah. And you know what, Jen, that's actually a very, very traumatic thing. It's a very damaging thing because, and I don't know if that would fall under the gaslighting term or not. Yeah. But part of it is, you know, when a situation like that occurs where you are, especially as a child, being yelled at and reprimanded for something in such a way that it has you in fear. And then, you know, the very next moment, it's as if nothing happened. It's yeah. teaching you that silence is the key. It's teaching yeah. you that, you know, no one wants to deal with it. Nobody wants to hear your view. Nobody wants to change. It's just sweeping it under the rug.
Yeah.
And I think for me, it sounds like a bit of a form of gaslighting where you begin to second guess yourself, right?
Yes.
So you say to yourself as a child, well, this really hurt me and I'm very scared, but nobody's addressing it. So maybe it's just me. And you kind of said that, Jen, where you kind of felt yeah. like there was something wrong with you. And I think that that's what that type of behavior does.
Yeah.
It takes it from their accountability and puts it onto you
yes,
as your
as a child.
Yes. And I think that that's where you begin to become conditioned, right?
Yeah.
So mm-hmm.
the other thing I was going to add is that it made me feel invisible
yeah.
and like I didn't matter and that I was worthless. Because I had the idea, if I was worth something, my parents would talk to me and share or explain or reconcile with me. But I was always in this place where I never felt like my dad and I were okay because these conversations after the punishment were completely non-existent. So that was rough. And he does and still does a little bit use the silent treatment with my mom. He like if she's trying to come to the table and share, you know, her feelings regarding something he said or did, he will close up on himself and just he goes into a hole of depression and just like self-abuse in a sense. But then it just doesn't help anything because it's almost like a punishment to my mom for opening up.
Yeah, that I would say it's more along the lines of it's absolutely a punishment. And the fact that your mom is probably most affected when treated that way, he will do it more, right? Because it's an effective, it becomes an effective punishment, similar to how spanking or hitting a child is a way to get them out, get them hurting, and then you don't have to deal with it anymore.
Yeah. It was rough. So seeing some of the patterns still existing, my dad is more of like a teddy bear now. Like he doesn't have rage issues as far as I know. I don't live in the house anymore. But he's on Prozac now as well as my mom. So that's kind of helped them a little bit. But it's rough, that childhood, because I really did feel responsible for the emotional atmosphere of the family. I just kind of took on this role of – it's my job to make sure dad doesn't get angry. If he's angry, it's my job to pat everything down around all of us to sort of make this smooth so that he doesn't get triggered into a rage again. So I felt very, very responsible.
You know, CeeLo, it's funny, Jen, because you're saying that. CeeLo, one of the things that you had mentioned just in the beginning when you were opening this episode was, you know, putting that emotional maturity, like, I guess, burden on a child, from the parent to the child. And I think that's what it sounds like, what Jen's describing right now.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of parents easily forget. And I mean, no parent out there is perfect. I get that. Mm-hmm. And we all make mistakes. But I think that sometimes parents forget that as a child, they're learning and it's your job to teach them. And sometimes you have to teach the same thing over and over, and they're not learning anything if you're abusing them, right? They're learning how to be a victim at that point, right? They're not learning how to approach a problem differently, or, you know, pick up after themselves, or like there's a whole long kind of list of things.
Yeah. Avoiding conflict.
Yeah, that's exactly. Or how to have a conversation with a friend or somebody in their lives. So, Jen, you mentioned that you have brothers, so you have siblings. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of curious to know what the pecking order is. Where do you fall in there? Do you have older or younger?
So I have two older brothers and one younger.
Okay.
So I guess you could call me sort of a middle child. Mm-hmm. One of my oldest brother is 5 years older than me. My next brother is 1 year older than me. And then my little brother is 5 years younger.
Oh my gosh. It's almost the exact same as me, except I'm the second oldest. Yeah.
Okay.
But it is our job as middle children to be the smoother over.
Yes. 100%. The peacemaker.
I feel like I pick up that sometimes in my family, certainly when we were younger, you know, if somebody was getting in trouble over here, or something was happening over there, I felt like it was my job to keep things, you know, smooth. I didn't like people yelling. I didn't like people getting mad, you know, totally avoiding conflict.
It terrified me.
Yeah.
Oh, question, Jen, like, I'm just wondering, when you talk about, you know, being responsible or feeling responsible to ensure that there was peace kept in the family, and, you know, that you were kind of monitoring everybody's, you know, mood and, you know, trying to make sure that you were behaving in such a way that wouldn't get anybody angry.
Yeah.
Do you feel that that was part of, I mean, I don't know, but do you feel like you're a bit of a people pleaser? Like, is that something that you have, that you feel that you need to do? Because when I listen to that, I'm thinking, geez, that sounds to me like you're getting primed to be that person who is going to be responsible for everybody else's feelings and do nothing but please people, right? And so what are your thoughts?
Yeah. My thoughts are, I learned codependency from my mom and just from the whole family dynamic. I definitely learned people pleasing because I think I thought, you know, I'm a bad kid, so I need to prove that I'm not. I need to prove that I'm lovable, that I'm worth having somebody come and talk to me about my feelings and connect with me emotionally. Mm-hmm. And because it wasn't happening, I was taking it personally. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, just from the model of my mom and just the modeling of the family, I kind of fell very quickly into that role of the disease to please. And it was sort of a coping mechanism. It was a way that I was trying to remain safe. Mm-hmm. Attempting to, because it really didn't necessarily work most of the time.
Right.
Things still blew up and then I'd feel like a failure. You know, I didn't do my job right. So that was rough. But yeah, that's been one of the hardest things to learn. Specifically in the last like year or two, I've been learning that when other people are upset, whether it's at me or because of something else, to sit in those uncomfortable feelings and hold back from wanting to rescue,
yeah.
from wanting to jump in and try to fix what's going on. Even if it's not my job or I didn't do anything, I'm not a part of it. It's just somebody over here is angry or hurting. It's been difficult for me to learn to sit back and take a deep breath and remind myself other people's feelings and emotions are not my responsibility.
Yeah. That's key.
That's been a big one, but gosh, you know, 41 years later,
mm-hmm. 41 I would years like later. Highlight that, put it in bold, put it in another line.
Yeah.
And I think as you were talking and Bo's first question about being a people pleaser, it's so related to being that smoother over, right? Like mm-hmm. I don't want to have the conflict. I know where this has the potential to go, and I've got this responsibility on me to be the one reeling everything in and smoothing it out. And so you kind of get born into your people pleaserness from being that person as a child and as a young adult or whatever that looks like. And then you become that people pleaser. Yeah.
There anybody from like your sibling side, Jen, anybody that was similar of any of your siblings to that? Like, did they become people pleasers too? Or was there one that was a specific favored child, or what was the dynamic like a little bit?
I don't feel like there's a favorite per se, mm-hmm. but what was the first question you asked? It just flew out of my head. If there was someone else similar?
Just the, like in terms of your siblings, right? So if you were the people pleaser, do you think that most of your siblings grew up also becoming people pleasers, or were there differences in their personalities? Or, you know, were each of your siblings treated differently from your parents? So you took on a specific role that maybe your other siblings didn't. I'm just trying to understand the whole dynamic.
Mm-hmm. I feel like my brother Mark, who is a year older than me, I think he too picked up on mm-hmm. People-pleasing tactics to try to smooth things over. I think I'm proud of this, but I think I held that more than he did. But, you know, I guess maybe being a woman and having more emotions and stuff and it being a little more socially acceptable for, you know, a girl to be more emotional than a guy mm-hmm. Or a boy. But I would say my oldest brother, Dave, there's not really any golden child stuff happening, but he was the one that I kind of feel like he was more like a real dad than my dad was. And even now, like there's some times where he'll talk to my parents like they're his kids and I'm like, ooh, you know, cringe. So I do think he definitely took on a role of being a parent, being parentified, you know, especially over us younger kids.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But there really wasn't any emotional attaching, you know, to each other, sharing feelings. I feel like me and my siblings kind of avoided each other. And even when it comes to what I do remember from our childhood, like I don't have any conscious memories of them getting spanked or sent to their room crying or anything like that. And like another example is I dealt with separation anxiety when I was in middle school with my mom. And there's a whole lot behind that. But I didn't realize that my brother Mark also dealt with this. Like when he had to go to school, he'd cry and just didn't want to go and wanted to stay with mom. I think part of that had to do with wanting to protect her. She felt like the safe parent, even though she had been doing things that were emotionally immature and destructive. But she was, out of the two of them, she was the safe parent. So I would say maybe a little bit of a difference with how they treated Dave. But across the board, it was pretty similar from what I can remember. But me and Mark were more of like the peacemakers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So do you, when you moved back in with your family, after your separation, and you begin to notice that maybe things were not quite right, you know, in the home. You talked a little bit about having shame and guilt in a sense of being able to talk about things. Did you try to speak out at that point once you began to see that things were not perfect? Did you say anything or?
Kind of. I still wasn't totally aware. Like it was when I started to become aware that something was off. And I started dating my now husband pretty soon after I left my ex, and my family had a huge issue with it. Mm. Now, on one hand, I totally understand. I think someone who has gotten out of abuse, you know, that the statistics show that it's, if you move on too quickly to another relationship, it might be more of the same, just looks, it's wrapped differently. Mm. I do think they had some fears regarding that, but what was the point I was going to make? Rabbit trailing in my brain.
About speaking out to your family.
Yes. Yeah. So I started seeing things more clearly with them. And I thought it was just because of the fact that they were upset that I was dating somebody so soon. Mm. But what I think was happening was they were still acting the same, but I was now noticing it more consciously. And I'll give you an example. I had some friends, actually Glenn and my now husband, Jason, we had been doing a radio show on YouTube for a year almost. And Glenn is in Australia, and him and his wife flew to the States to go to Florida, but they wanted to meet us in person because we hadn't met in person yet. And so Jason was in South Carolina, and he was going to come up and pick Glenn and his wife up and take them back to South Carolina. So the four of us were sitting in the living room, and my mom was talking to us and while they were there visiting, because I was living with my parents. So they came and stayed at my parents' house while I was there. Excuse me, this is right before I left my ex, actually. So we're all sitting down, we're talking about the show and talking about life. And my mom had put out cheese and crackers, and I was eating some of them, and Glenn and Jason are there. And she said something about my weight, something along the lines of, you know, should you be eating those cheese and crackers because you haven't been walking as much? And I did not hear this comment at all. Glenn and Jason later that evening, they were like, what was up with that comment your mom said? And I was like, what comment? And they shared with me what she said. And I was flabbergasted that I had no memory of it. And I think even that particular situation, that happening, was another step in taking the blinders off of my eyes, because I do believe now, and being more aware of it from this instance and then forward, seeing things more clearly and catching things, that my mom has been very critical. And she has made comments over the years that are sort of passive aggressive and under the radar, but they still affected me on a subconscious level. But I had gotten to the point where I was just, there was like this amnesic barrier between me and my mom when she said things like this. Because after this thing happened, it took more of the fog off of my brain and my ears. And I started noticing things, and it was like she was a completely different person than this fantasy mom I had sort of built up in my head. Does that make sense?
It does. It really does make sense. And I think that is common for emotionally immature parents or even narcissistic parents. It's a tactic, I think, that is used to, you know, second guess your confidence and you know, make you more codependent on them, but also to bring your self-esteem down and your confidence down so that you're more easily molded, right? Because if you feel that there is something wrong with you, then you tend to be a little bit more compliant.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's, I think, a tactic that's quite common. And then doing it in front of people to shame you and embarrass you.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not that's cool. Tough.
Blows my fucking mind. I mean, my upbringing was far from perfect, like lots of different issues all sprinkling all around. But, you know, my mom's rule was, if you have nothing nice to say, say nothing at all. Right.
Yep.
And so, like, I don't understand how a parent could say something like that to their child, even adult child or whatever. The other thing that I was thinking about as you were chatting is that, you know, it was easier to see and recognize, it sounds like, because of how your dad treated you more on the physical side, whereas your mom was just as bad, but it was all on the emotional side. And I don't think you need to to think of a response. I'm just like putting it out there that it's like people put a higher, you know, value or a higher badness rating on physical abuse than emotional. And yes, they can have equal, if not more, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, impact to someone. Absolutely. You know? Yeah. And I'm wondering,
and my dad,
yeah, sorry, go ahead, Jen.
Okay. Oh, no, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I wonder just with what CeeLo was saying, I'm wondering if that's partly because it is easier to comprehend something physical because you can see it than it is the emotional side that you can't. Because I think a lot of the times with the physical aspect, I mean, it's out in the open, right? People are going to see some type of telltale sign at some point in time that's going to get them to question and believe your story. But when it's emotional, then it's his word against hers or hers against hers, or, you know, and then it becomes,
or you took it the wrong way.
Yeah.
It was just a joke.
Different type of battle because not everybody understands the effects of emotional abuse.
It's like there's a hard line on the physical. You're either hitting someone or you're not hitting someone. But on the emotional, it's this like sandy, watery line that somewhere in there that I can have an opinion on where that line is. Bo could have a different opinion and Jen could have a different opinion altogether, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
So that's interesting, Jen. So when you – so now you're starting to discover that your family might not be as perfect as you thought they were going to be, right? Yeah. Okay. Or that they were. So talk to us a little bit about your first husband, because you said that you had met your first husband and that he was, you believe he was narcissistic?
Not when I met him, but I do now believe that he is. Uh-huh.
So how
when
did
I met him? Mm-hmm. Well, it's a funny story. He was dating a friend of mine for like 2 months and she ended up saying to me that if anything happened between us or if something blocked, I think she could see that there was like a connection. I was not aware of it. This friendship that I had was not very healthy. It was very, very codependent, toxic in some ways. And, I'm not quite I can't speak on her intentions behind sort of steering me toward him. It was very strange. So they ended up breaking up and we ended up getting together. And I don't know if there was like, she didn't like him and was like, here, you can have him, or I'm not quite sure, but we did start dating. This was in 2004. And, he mirrored me. And I didn't know anything about mirroring. I didn't know anything about love bombing. He didn't have to do a lot of love bombing because my self-esteem was so low. My standards were on the floor. I didn't think anybody would want me. That was kind of my mind frame back then, that the little attention that he gave me was just, it blew my mind. It was like I was starving my whole life. And then someone threw me a couple of breadcrumbs and I was like, this is the best thing ever. So we started dating and he was very good at mirroring me. I thought I had met my soulmate.
So what do you mean by mirroring you? What do you mean by that?
So he would claim to like the same things I did, like the same music that I did, was loved family like I did. It was things like that. And he was very talkative and shared a lot in the beginning. Whereas after we got married, that fell off the map and he was so closed off to the point where when I left him 13 years later, I was like, I do not know this person. You know, I know his rage. I know his triggers. I know, you know, all these more surfacey things about him, but he had never let me in to like really truly know him. So that was interesting.
It was kind of like in the beginning, it's, oh, you like this type of music. Okay. Now I like this type of music. It's you like, you know, your family's like this. Oh, my family's like this. That's what you mean. Okay. That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. It was strange. He definitely had a mask on and wasn't completely honest with me about a lot of things.
I'm sure. So your relationship progresses. And so walk us through what made you feel like he was somebody that you wanted to marry.
You know, back then, I like to say that a part of me was a spiritualizer. So I would spiritualize things and think, oh, this is of God, to try to convince myself that it was the right path to go down. And at that time, I was more of a baby Christian. That's a popular term. So I didn't know a lot of the Bible. I kind of only knew what people had told me at church. And I had, become a Christian, got saved, all that stuff. But I just really spiritualized how he came into my life, like the fact that he was dating my friend. And then she was like, hey, maybe there's something between you guys. I was like, oh, it's God, you know?
Yeah, like a divine intervention.
Yeah. And I didn't know, I was not equipped, and I'm sure you ladies can validate this with your own stories, but I wasn't equipped with boundaries, how to say no. I wasn't taught, you know, what an identity is and how to get it, you know, within yourself. I just was like ripe for the picking. So when there was things happening, even in the beginning, I had had this like sort of track record of becoming the person that I dated, like sort of because I just didn't really have an identity and I didn't know what that was. In my younger, immature mind, I thought, well, if I like the same things other people like, or if I bend and twist myself to fit this person, then they won't leave. They'll love me. They'll love me more and they won't leave. And I definitely had some abandonment issues and rejection issues, wounds and stuff. So that's kind of how it started. Did we lose her?
No, I think she's
still. Oh, she's still there.
Yeah. I'm here. Okay, I'm having network issues, so I just turned off the cameras.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So shoot, what was the question?
I think one of the things that you were talking about when you were saying he was mimicking was really interesting, because I feel like it's a form of we've talked before about the love bombing kind of phase of things, and the fact that they're using that as a tactic to get you, mm-hmm. you know, hook yes. you, get you on side, get you feeling like, oh my, this couldn't be any more perfect, because it's like, yep. I'm here, here's here. And it just goes yep. like, such
it's like a too good to be true.
Yeah, too good to be true. Exactly. So how could you possibly even consider questioning it or, yeah. you know, challenging it or challenging him in any way, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so things were pretty okay when we dated. I was very, what is the word? I very much acquiesced to the things that he liked to do. I didn't know how to have my own opinion or my own wants and to voice them. I was very much like go along to get along sort of personality at that
you
got time.
The people pleaser in you, Jen. Yeah. That's it right exactly. there. Yeah.
So the only time that something was off, there was two things that happened out of like 6 months that we dated, because we got engaged after 6 months of dating. And one of the first things was he took us hiking for my birthday and he bought me a new camera and all these lenses and a camera bag, which was part of the love bombing. And so we went hiking on my birthday in the Blue Ridge Mountains and we got lost. I don't know how it happened, but we ended up hiking like 7 miles down this mountain and had to turn around and walk 7 miles back up. And so during this happening, I'm like, I'm outdoors. I love nature. I love hiking. I love taking pictures. And I also was very trained, but I think this is a part of my personality too, to make the best out of every situation. Mm. Like there's always a silver lining. I'm very optimistic. So he was getting really upset. And I think he felt like this, us getting lost on this trail, and then it started to rain. He just was so pissed off at the whole happening and felt like it was ruining my birthday. And I was trying to tell him, hey, you know, this is fine. Like, this is a memory. We'll years down the road, we'll laugh about it. But it was like he couldn't let it go. He just was so angry. And it was the first time I had seen him really, really angry in this kind of dynamic that panned out throughout the rest of the marriage was sort of happening in that moment. I just thought he was really upset because he had these plans for my yeah. birthday and they didn't go according to plan. And then when he was going to propose to me months later, we were at dinner at Outback and he started talking to me about fishing, like how much he loved fishing. And then he turned the conversation to me and he wanted me to promise him that I would love fishing as much as he did. And it was very weird because I was like, how am I even supposed to know if I'm going to, you know, like I've been fishing a couple of times, yeah. but I can't promise, you know, that I'm going to love it as much as you. How am I even going to know that? It was so weird. And that was very much a red flag that I missed. Mm-hmm. Now, the next day, he actually told me, because we ended up getting into a fight about it. And then we ended up leaving dinner and he was going to propose, but then didn't. And so the next day he proposed and he told me, you know, I was going to propose last night, but because, you know,
you ruined it.
This thing. Yeah. I was like, wait, goodness. It was so weird.
Oh.
Oh yeah, it was very, very strange. Yeah.
That's not
red flag.
Well, yeah, that is like, that is that is just such a manipulation tactic to make you feel like you were less than, or that something was wrong with you. You know, it's, he's just starting to break you down. Yeah. That's what he's starting
to do. You've jeopardized. Yeah. You've jeopardized it for having an opinion, for questioning me.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Also, I can't now stop thinking about that Bloomin' Onion from Outback. Remember those Bloomin' Onions? Yeah, that big fried onion thing?
That was so good. The mouth watering in the dip that they give you with it. Oh, so delicious.
So good. Gotta find me at Outback.
This particular instance at Outback pretty much set the stage for the whole marriage, because the whole marriage, it was the same dynamic of trying to turn me into something that he wanted, which was giving me the message that who I was as I was not was not enough. What he wanted.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm talking like he wanted me to be blonde. He wanted me to cut my hair short. Like there was all these things happening that just kept giving me the message. You're not good enough. You're not what I want. You're not good enough. You're not worthy of my love, all of these things. And it just,
So he was trying to change your physical appearance, Jen? Like he was actually trying to change?
A little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as bad, you know, and I'm not trying to minimize my experience, but it wasn't as bad as some stories I've heard where it's like controlling what you wear and what makeup you wear. It wasn't like that, but it definitely was these little reminders every now and then that he wanted me to change my appearance. And like, not that he came out and said it outright, mm-hmm. but it was giving me the message that how I look
wasn't good enough. It just wasn't good enough. There's an episode that CeeLo and I record as well, where I provide some of examples that I've gone through with an ex of mine, Jen, and it's almost identical. In terms of they start to try to get you to question your self-confidence, right? So if he likes me better blonde, then I must not look as good with brown hair now, right? Yes. Like if exactly. So it begins to chip away at your confidence for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that line of thinking was already planted from my childhood of questioning myself and just not trusting not trusting that I knew myself better than other people. I was always trying to get other people to tell me who I was. And so when I went into this marriage and he started doing these things, it was playing right into that programming, you know, if I'm not good enough and, you know, maybe if I do this or that or the other, this person will love me or be attracted to me and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, just based on what you were talking about with your family life originally when you were younger, it's like you can see the clear line there of how your parents made you codependent on them. And so that was the behavior that you had learned. And so now this person is trying to make you codependent on them, you know, and then it's the people pleasing and the shame and guilt and the feelings of not good enough. It's kind of mimicking what you had explained growing up. So,
it was like a million times worse. It seemed like he wanted me to be a mini him. And I think he wanted me to be a robot as well. Goodness. And over the years I started becoming a robot. I was so, I just kept backing up into myself to try to make myself smaller and not have any wants or any needs or any opinions, because anytime I tried to express myself, it seemed to get punished. It made him mad. It made him upset. It made him angry. And so I kept getting that message too. I need to become smaller. I need to not voice my opinions or who I am or be who I am, because it's upsetting this person that I love. And it's safer to try to continue to be whatever it is that he wants me to be so there can be some peace. And that just was very, very destructive. But again, I was prepped to sort of acquiesce
to be that's how you grew up. Yeah. What do you think was the tipping point to you finding your voice and realizing this isn't for me, this isn't who I am, I need to get out of this?
Yeah, this is a cool story. So Glenn and Jason, who I was doing the radio show with, and we had other people around the world, mostly in the States, that would come on and be a part of the panel. Like right now, we just have four people on the panel, but we used to invite other people on and do it a little bit differently. And but having contact with Glenn, especially, like we would be talking, the three of us would be talking on Facebook Messenger. And the friendship that I built with these two men that were so open and so direct and so authentic, I felt like it was the first time I've ever found my people. It was like I had been in the dark my whole life, and meeting these two people sort of turned the light on for me. I was like, oh my gosh, there's other people out there that have as many questions as I do, but more. And they're okay expressing it, and they're okay asking, and they're okay if your opinion differs. Like, it, it was such a breath of fresh air. And the care and the love that I got from these two friends, because there was nothing weird going on behind the scenes with my now husband when we were friends. I know, it's like, but it was like experiencing that kind of acceptance from them within this friendship regarding the show and just conversations around the show mm-hmm. and the topics. It made me realize that I like, this was in a way what I had always wanted within a marriage, this openness and this authenticity and accepting value of one another.
And that you had
value. Mm-hmm. So not to mention, and this is kind of cool, Glenn had dated Jason's mom years ago when she had divorced my husband's dad. Mm-hmm. And so there was a connection there, and they used to write each other and send each other like little tiny tapes. They'd record and mail it and then record and mail back. And, you know, it's like back in the day. And so there was a few letters of hers that she had written Glenn that were kind of mapping out and explaining the struggle, because she ended up going back to Jason's dad. Oh. And he is a narcissist.
Yeah.
He's like a quiet narcissist, but it's not good. So in her explaining the mistakes that she made in not loving herself and not finding worth in herself and how that played out and how she went back to this prison of a marriage, because of her Christian values, she really convinced herself that God wanted her to get back together with her ex. Mm-hmm. And it, she ended up dying early.
I believe so.
Mm-hmm. It was almost like she was speaking to me from beyond the grave, and that might sound woo-woo, and that's okay. But it was sort of me getting a glimpse into my life in a way, if I had stayed with my ex. Mm. And I did not want that. I was like, it just gave me this little glimpse of what I had to look forward to. So meeting them and having these very real and open friendships, and then these letters from Linda, Jason's mom, it was almost like being in friendship with these people sort of helped me build back up my self-esteem and self-worth mm-hmm. and self-love. And it was from that reservoir that started to build that I realized things are not going to change. This person does not want to change. He doesn't, mm-hmm. he thinks everything's fine the way it is, and he doesn't care about me, and I need to get the hell out of here. And there was one comment he said to me that finally ripped the glasses off my face, the rose-colored glasses. We had gotten back from a buying trip up in Massachusetts. We were antiques dealers, and so we'd go on the road and like find treasures and, you know, antiques and all kinds of stuff. Vintage clothes is like very much my heart. But and we got back, and there were two customers yanking on our front doors at our store, and the hours for the store were next to the front door, and my ex-husband started freaking out about these people yanking on the door. And we were behind a faux wall, and he's screaming at me. He's going off on them, but in my face. And this was kind of like our life. He would get mad at me or other people, but I was still getting screamed at. Yeah. And when he was done, I went to the bathroom. I sat on the toilet. I was bawling. And I just was telling God, I was like, I want to die. I just want to die. I was at the end of my rope. I was way past the end of my rope. And so I cleaned myself up. I went back out back for, because he was continuing to unload the van. And he wanted to know if I was okay. And I said I was fine, because this was sort of a trick he always did. He would ask if I was okay and act like he cared. And I would say I'm fine. And then when he'd press me, I'd share, but then he'd flip it back on me as to mm-hmm. being my fault.
Right.
And then he would minimize his rage. Oh, I just flipped out a little bit. You're overreacting. And I'm like, dude, you are screaming in my face, like yeah. spittle flying, red face, steam coming out of your ears. This is not just a little freak out. And then out of the blue, he said to me, if you go to jail for our back taxes, I'll keep running the store.
Oh, jeez.
And this was, we weren't talking about it. It just was out of the blue. And it was like someone had slapped me.
Yeah.
So he had convinced me to open this business in my name under my social security number.
Of course.
And then throughout the business, he was spending like he was a millionaire, would not keep mm-hmm. track of funds. I mean, there was so much financial abuse. it was insane. And it was killing me because I was always stressed out about the money and the IRS and, you know, all the stuff. He kept promising business loans that were taken out would pay off our back taxes. We would get the loan into our bank and he'd blow all the money. This happened like 5 times in a row. And I'm like, when am I going to realize this person is lying to me? Like, you know, he's lying to me to get the loan. And then when it gets there, it's just spent. So this particular comment he made about the taxes, it was the last straw for me. I finally saw him clearly and I was like, this person does not love me. He does not care about me. He's just using me. And then I think it was like a week later I left.
Wow.
And up until that leaving point, I was making plans and trying to figure out, you know, how this was going to work out.
Cause so, you could feel like it was coming. You were starting to realize. So it's almost like you start to make little plans, putting money aside, thinking about how you're going to get exit out of this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was kind of hoping you would say you went into the bathroom, you had a little cry, cleaned yourself up, walked out the door and just kept walking.
Fuck you.
Right. Fuck you. Yeah. I think it's amazing that, you know, you're sharing this story and to think that, you know, Jason and Greg, were there and helped you realize. And now hopefully by sharing your story, somebody out there is realizing. So absolutely. I think that's so awesome and, you know, courageous of you to do that.
Thank you.
I think so too.
Yeah. One of the biggest things in my own healing journey has been hearing other people's stories. It's been so validating. And I've even learned a lot of things that I didn't know before by listening to other people's stories. And so if that can help anybody, you know, just talking and sharing, I'm like, I want to be a part of that because so many people have been part of my journey, you know, on the flip side.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, Jen. And that is how people learn and how people change and how people grow. It's by having this human connection with each other and sharing these common stories and these situations that help us learn for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's great. So I, Jen, we want to thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you sharing. And for now, this is Bo.
And this is CeeLo.
And join us next time. Thank you.
Thanks for taking a seat at the table today. We love our dinner guests.
Don't forget to subscribe and follow The Dinner Agenda on the podcast platform you use so that you don't miss any new episodes. You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook at The Dinner Agenda.
We look forward to hearing your comments, questions, and even ideas you may have on future episodes.
Thanks for taking this journey with us.